Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, Bergen County. This is John Enslin. I cover Bergen County government and politics for the paper, for the Record, and I want to welcome you to another edition of Record Talk Radio, our ongoing series of conversations with newsmakers and journalists from throughout northern New Jersey. We've got a double feature for you today on this cold and cloudy day, 41 degrees outside the Record Talk Radio studios. First off, I'm going to play excerpts of an interview that was the basis for a story that you'll find in today's Record. I interviewed outgoing Bergen County Prosecutor John Molinelli yesterday in his office. He's in the waning weeks of his 14-year tenure, and as you'll hear, we'll talk about what he considers some of the accomplishments, as well as some of the controversial cases that he's handled in that 14-year span. Then later in the program, my colleague Bill Ervolino will be checking in. Bill had a great story in Sunday's Record that I very much recommend to you. It is about that generation of Bobby Soxers, the young women who flocked to New York City's Paramount Theater to hear a young crooner from Hoboken named Frank Sinatra. And of course, Sinatra's 100th birthday is coming up this Saturday. So we'll talk with Bill about that. But first, let's get to Prosecutor Molinelli, who, like I said, I did this interview in his office yesterday. He will be stepping down as prosecutor on effective January 1. Let's hear what he had to say. John Molinelli, welcome back to Record Talk Radio.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here for the second time.
Second time and probably last as a county prosecutor, right?
I would agree with you on that.
Okay. Today is, after all, what, December the 7th, and I believe your term will be up by January 1?
That's correct. My last day here will be January 1. I'm actually taking just 2 weeks off. I mean, I don't get vacation. It doesn't work that way with the prosecutor, but I'm taking 2 weeks off. I know that I'm going to have to still be available as part of a transition, whoever is here, so I can almost guess that although I'm going to be out of the office for 2 weeks, I'm probably going to be spending quite a bit of time on the phone. And then I will come back on January 15th to say my goodbyes to the office. But you're correct. As of January 1, I pretty much will no longer be here.
Any inkling as to who your successor is?
No inkling whatsoever. None whatsoever.
We wanted to talk to you about the 14 years that you've served in this post as essentially the county's chief law enforcement officer. And in advance of this interview, your office sent over a kind of lengthy list of things that were considered administrative accomplishments. And it's quite a long list, 14 pages. Initiated a computer crimes unit, centralized criminal intelligence data sharing, jail diversion for people with mental illness who are accused, a joint task, a gang task force. Yeah, these are all fairly important things that have happened in the last 14 years. I'm wondering, when you look at this list, what do you consider the two or three most significant in terms of the change they brought about?
Well, the computer crimes unit obviously is one that I'm very, very proud of. Most county law enforcement agencies do not have the resources to really have a true computer crime unit. There is a forensic lab down in Hamilton. It's operated by the state police and the FBI. There's a time factor involved. You know, I really started the computer crimes unit originally to go after the online predators against our kids, and we still do that today, to catch the people that are trafficking in child pornography, to go online and find the people that are taking advantage of undocumented immigrants with regard to, enslaving them to perform prostitution. But where it really morphed was every single case we deal with, every single case that a local police department deals with, there's always a cell phone, there's always a computer. And when we seize those computers, we often have significant evidence on the crime. So it has nothing to do with the predator, has nothing to do with child pornography. Indeed, the Eights homicide case, a significant amount of the evidence was computer forensic. The case being tried right now, which I don't really want to talk too much about, but the Mr. Cantor's homicide in Teaneck, there has been a significant amount of cyber evidence introduced. These are cases that years ago we might not have even been able to prosecute but for the Computer Crimes Unit. We have our own dedicated lab, which really very few agencies in this country have. It has a large full-time staff. Generally, I use civilians now. And what we do is we just seize all type of cyber evidence, and I'm very proud of that.
Okay, in the latter part of the interview, I also talked to John Mullinelli about some of the controversial cases his office has been involved in and whether he had any regrets about those. You'll hear him reference one in particular here, the case involving former Hackensack Police Chief Ken Ziza. That was a case that where the appellate court overturned the convictions that were obtained at trial by Mullinelli's office in a rather sharply worded decision that was critical of prosecutors. You'll hear Mullinelli acknowledge that the decision ultimately as to whether to retry one misconduct charge in that case will not be his decision. So let's listen to what he had to say.
So, John, looking back on these 14 years, is there anything you regret? And by regret, I mean either, you know, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, I might have done this case differently or I might have done this approach differently, or regret in the sense of, you know, I've started some things that I'm clearly not going to be able to finish in the 3 weeks that remain. Anything in that category?
Well, that's pretty good. I mean, on the Operation Jersey Boys, there was something that if I had known could have been done, I would have done it. I can't be specific because that record is, at least the pleadings are under seal, not necessarily what happened. There's always things that, looking in hindsight, you would certainly have done differently. And obviously there's been some things that didn't turn out the way I wanted them to. But that doesn't mean that I would not have done them. You know, there's too many, and I see them. Fortunately, our chiefs are terrific. My colleagues are great. But there's a lot of people throughout this country that, you know, they just want to stay below the radar. They don't want to do anything controversial. And they're afraid to challenge and go after the tough case. So in the ones that didn't work out the way I wanted them to, I wouldn't do it any differently. You know, the Ziza case obviously has been a case that you read about it a lot in the paper. That is not a case that I would have really wanted to see our office do any differently.
Let's stop and talk about that for a second. Last time, I believe you and I talked about that, the plan was to retry that case. And that's still, as I understand, speaking today, the case. But isn't that a decision that's going to be left up to your successor?
That's correct. I mean, if the person that comes in and replaces me chooses to not pursue that case, that will be his or her prerogative. I would hope that that person, whomever it is, recognizes that that is a potentially difficult decision as it relates to this county and more particularly the city of Hackensack and its police department. But that will be the prerogative. I mean, we've already indicated that we're going to retry it. A motion has to be heard on January 20th in terms of whether or not the case should proceed on what's called double jeopardy grounds. I don't want to get too complicated about it. But that's not a case that I would have thought our office would have handled any differently if it occurred again today. Our office, and I'm very proud to say this, have never, ever shied away from proceeding against a law enforcement officer. We've had many, many cases involving police. When a law enforcement agency like ours, because of fear of what's going to happen, decides to turn the other way, that is against the interests of the million people that live in this county. There needs to be some agency that, without fear, is going to take these cases, and we've always done that. So I have no regrets in that area. You know, there's always going to be things. I'll think about your question a month from now, and I'll say, oh, I wish I had said that.
Because, you can still call.
Yeah, I'm sure there's always going to be things that I would have done differently. But as I sit here now, I think that, even the two or three cases we talked about, you also have to put that in perspective. Over 14 years, there's probably been over 50,000 cases that have come through this office.
All right, and in this final segment, you'll hear John Mulinelli talking about how difficult it's going to be for him to walk away from this job.
When I talk to you about this office, I mean, you seem very much steeped in the details of it still. You don't seem like somebody who's a short-termer at the moment. Is this going to be a hard job for you to leave, to walk away from?
Sure, it will. It'll be the greatest job that I will ever have. There's no question about that. Former Mercer County Prosecutor Dan Giaquinto told me that 14 years ago, and he was right. It's the greatest job you'll ever have because, you know, nowhere do you get an opportunity to really make a difference in people's lives. So it will be difficult. What's a little easier for me is before I was ever the county prosecutor, I was in the private practice. You know, many of my friends, even in this office, they've spent their career here. And then they go into the private practice, and they really don't have any idea what to expect. Where I'm going, the Price Meese, Shulman, Dorminio, and Wycliffe Lake, I know all of them. Gail Price and I clerked, back in 1982, and I'm very comfortable returning to the private practice. So that will ease the angst. I'm going to continue to root for everyone here. You asked me what my greatest legacy is. It's not any case. It's not any building. It's the people that I have been blessed to work with and the people that I've hired. You know, my first assistant and I, we kid that if we ever sent a resume to this office today, we'd never get in. Our standards are very, very high. We have been blessed to hire some outstanding kids over the years. And in fact, I've hired over 75% of the office. So they're, for the first time in their career, transitioning to a new prosecutor. It's a tough time for them, but I think they're going to do fine, and I'm going to continue to be their biggest fan when I open up the record in the future and read about their accomplishments.
Okay. You are the chief law enforcement officer of this county. What are your thoughts, briefly, on what are the biggest challenges facing law enforcement in Bergen County at the moment?
Every person, whether you're a police officer or not, we all have biases. For most of us, it's very subconscious to us. We don't think about it. We don't realize it. But it exists, and law enforcement needs to come to the realization that it exists, and they need to work on that. And, you know, one of the programs that I'm going to do before I leave is the Fair and Impartial Policing. I've had it reviewed by a couple of community leaders, including Anthony Curitan of the NAACP. Rich Rivera, who I have a very good relationship with, has reviewed it, and I think it'll be a good program. So I think continuing to help the trust factor between the public and law enforcement is a significant challenge for law enforcement because of what's going on out there. You know, we watch television and we read about things that happened in Ferguson and in Chicago. And what that does is it raises the suspicion of the public here in Bergen that their own police are that way. And nothing could be further from the truth. But on the other hand, law enforcement also needs to understand that they need to do everything they possibly can to learn ways to recognize biases so as to be able to avoid them so that we truly will have fair and impartial policing.
Okay, folks, that was my interview yesterday with outgoing Bergen County Prosecutor John Mulinelli. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Record Talk Radio, an ongoing series of conversations with newsmakers and journalists in northern New Jersey, and we're blessed to be joined here today by my colleague Bill Ervolino. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good today. Hey, I really enjoyed reading your piece in Sunday's Record on that generation of young women who became known as the Bobby Soxers. who flocked to Frank Sinatra's early concerts at the Paramount in New York City. It was a great read. I'm wondering, how did you decide to do that story?
Well, you know, we're talking about his centennial, so there was a lot of stories being kicked around. But I happened to grow up with a Bobby Soxer, and constantly hearing about this guy and his music. And
there was a Bobby Soxer called Mom, I gather.
My mother. And
yes.
No, I mean, my father was. And this is basically, you know, Sinatra's allure is, you know, the men loved him and the women loved him, and you know, for different reasons, but. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother was a huge fan and still is, and, you know, they're always playing his music. And so she would tell me about going to the Paramount and going, you know, cutting school to go see him in concert. And so I said, let me find some of these women because I know they're around. They're in their late 80s, early 90s now. And, you know, and of course they just love talking about him. So it's fun.
Oh, and they were great. They were great to listen to. I mean, I love the woman you quoted who admitted she played hooky to go to the concerts, and she says, I guess it's okay, I can say that now, I'm going to be 95. <It's> like,
in August, yeah.
Great quote. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and, you know, they even wore the same outfits. They'd wear these, you know, black skirts and these sweaters with the shirt and the dickie and the string of pearls, and, of course, the Bobby socks and saddle shoes, which was
right.
Kind of like you know, I mean, it's just funny for, you know, for someone who, like me, who grew up in the, you know, I was born in the 50s, but grew up in the 60s, you think of youth culture and you kind of forget that your parents were that age at one time and did
exactly.
These sort of things.
Exactly. I mean, my mom is in that same category. She was a Bobby Soxer. She would take the bus over to New York and hear those concerts, which your story reminded me were not the only thing on playing those days. He would be singing in the afternoon, and then they'd play a movie and a short. So he was really tapped into popular culture on several fronts.
Yeah, well, I mean, his career encompassed all of those things. But I think, you know, in those days, yeah, and I think it kind of started in the 30s, you would go to the movies, you'd be there all day, and there were a lot of Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney used to do shows, you know, all day long. You know, a movie would open and they would come out and they would sing two songs and, you know, wave to their fans, whatever. And so you'd get like a mini concert and the movie and all of that thing. It was fun. I mean, you know, you could stay there all day. Today it's $12 or $18 and you're out in 2 hours.
Right, exactly. When I was reading an interesting book by Pete Hamill recently, called Why Sinatra Matters, and Hamill's take on it was that Sinatra was unique in American recording stars in that he started out with this base of really primarily young women who screamed and, you know, swooned, but that in the end of his career it was a predominantly male following.
Something that also interests me from that period, because I would ask them about the songs that they liked. You know, we think of Sinatra as being this 40s singing star who just hung on, but actually most of the songs that we think about from him are from the 50s and 60s. That was really the height of his recording career and performing career. You know, so even a song like My Way, which I think was 69 or 70, that was, you know, and working with Sammy Kahn in the 50s and Paul Anka and a bunch of other, you know, I mean, eventually he did Beatles stuff and everything, but his big swing songs, you know, really 50s and 60s when rock and roll was already, you know, pretty firmly entrenched. So his career is very unusual in that way. You know, she mentioned one song. I'm trying to think of the name of it. She said that it gave her chills when she sang it. And I'm like, I don't even know if I remember this song. You and Me, We Wanted It All. And I was
I
don't even know if I know
it. I don't know that song either because it's not
yeah,
a song
I mean,
that most people associate with Sinatra. So interesting, though. It stuck. I mean, clearly these women, I mean, Hamill wrote about how a lot of women abandoned Sinatra after his marriage and breakup with Ava Gardner, but it doesn't sound like these women that you interviewed totally disowned him for that.
Now, that was a pivotal point, and I think that, you know, we now know from all the books that were written about him that he was running around with everybody and involved with Lana Turner when he was married. And I think that, you know, I mean, this is how a lot of people are. We don't know about them until after what they're doing. And I think if they had known all about this, they would have been kind of turned off, you know, because teenage girls have a kind of a romantic attachment to the singing idol. You know, they idealize him in that way. And he was, I don't think, the greatest husband. And so I think that, but, you know, when it was publicly, finally, you know, that he divorced the sweet girl, you know, the childhood sweetheart, to marry this screen siren. I mean, Ava Gardner was quite, you know, a beautiful, striking woman. And, you know, kind of vampy looking. I think it bothered him. But she helped, she really helped his career also. Because at that time, he was at a bad point in his career. And she really helped him get from eternity and so on,
and
he was crazy about her. I mean, forever. And when she died, he took it very, very badly.
Mm-hmm.
By then, he had, you know, another 73 women in between. But I remember when we were on vacation, and we got the newspaper. This was like in the 60s, and reading this thing, it's like Frank Sinatra married Mia Farrow. And my mother was like, "Oh my God," you know. Like, like, just was like, now what? You know, what is he doing? He's lost his mind.
Right.
But
there was a great line in the Hamill book where he tells Pete Hamill, "I don't know what that was about." I still don't know what that was about.
Yes, and you know, he knew her when she was a little girl. I mean, he knew the family.
Yeah.
And but I think I think they seriously fell in love with each other. And I mean, I've read like every book about them, and you know, I think they had a really interesting relationship. But of course, there was that generation gap. And after they broke up, that's when she went with the Beatles to see the Maharishi, and she had no money. She didn't take any money from him, and she was just wandering around. She had no money in her pocket. I mean, she totally, you know, started living her hippie part of her life, and then she came back and went back to her career.
Right. Yeah. No, that's when I just look back at Sinatra's life, and I just say, go figure on that one.
Yeah. I had written an essay on Sunday also about how I did not, because my mother was a Bobby Soxer, and because I was had to listen to that all the time, how I kind of rejected him altogether. I mean, in the generation gap that I was part of, Sinatra was, you know, the old guy. And it wasn't really until, I guess, the early 90s that I finally started to look at him very objectively and appreciate how terrific. What a great, not only a great performer, but just, you know, when you hear him on records, you know, his voice, the elocution, his phrasing, everything about him was really quite amazing.
Right. Yeah, I have to admit to the same kind of approach. I was not a big fan of his growing up. You know, I remember my stepdad was, but, you know, it just didn't resonate. And now as I get older, those songs, they really do resonate, don't they?
Yeah, and his voice was, you know, he had great breath control. I interviewed his daughter many times, and Nancy, who also was a terrific performer, but she just didn't like doing it. I saw her performing at Limelight and The Bottom Line in the 90s, and she was just really good. But she just didn't like it, and people make fun of her and said, oh, she had one record or whatever, but she actually had several. And we talked about him, and you know, I mean, the kids are really the keepers of the flame with his, as far as his legacy is concerned. And you know, she would tell me all these things about him. First of all, that she really felt that because his career started even before the 30s. I mean, he was singing all over the place as a kid. That it was kind of like the soundtrack of the 20th century. And it's interesting to look at it that way. She also told me that he wasn't really much of a smoker because of his voice, that he always would have the cigarette as a prop, but he knew better than to smoke very much.
I know that.
And he's wherever he went, he wanted a pool because he wanted to swim every day to build up his,
chest, lung power.
Lung power. And I have to try that, actually.
Right.
A pool somewhere.
Right. Well, you know, let's talk. My final question to you, Bill, is this. I mean, let's talk about that legacy. One interesting thing to me this year is it's also the 100th anniversary of a couple of other, you know, amazing singers and recording artists. Billie Holiday, born 100 years ago. Edith Piaf, born 100 years ago. The great composer for Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn, born 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And yet, really, the one person for whom all these concerts are springing up all over the place is Sinatra, Old Blue Eyes. Why do you think his legacy has such a hold over the American imagination compared to, you know, some of his peers from that period, some of whom, I mean, Sinatra acknowledged kind of a debt to Billie Holiday's music in his own. But what do you think it is that's...
Well, as far as Billie was just amazing, but she died so young that, you know, in the 70s, you know, when Lady Sings the Blues came out, there was that whole period of remembering her and celebrating her, which I think the 70s was a huge decade for her, you know, in part because of the movie, a lot of young people discovered her. With Sinatra, he's just terrific. I mean, and, you know, I mean, all these people are that you mentioned, but I think that there is that joy of discovery. I'm not sure our kids will feel the same way, but, you know, I hate to sound like the old man, but I don't know what they listen to. But when you listen to his songs about, and they're just great songs. They're classic American songbook material that just, I think, is about love and about growing up and about getting older and about things that everybody feels. And he sings them so well that, you know, a lot of times you'll say you hear a love song and you don't notice it, and then suddenly you break up with someone and the song touches you. And I think
right.
that he sings songs because he was around for so long, you know, that from every part of your life. And when you hear, so like for me, it was a very good year. That did it for me when I saw him recording that. There's video of that. And I just sat there with my mouth hanging open, looking at him doing this, and how I could just visualize everything he was saying and what he was feeling at that point in his life, you know, at 50 years old. And it's quite amazing. So I think if that legacy is just about great material sung by, you know, one of the best singers of the 20th century, I guess.
All right. Well, Bill, listen, thank you for, I know you're traveling today, so thank you for checking in with us. It's always good to talk to you on the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All right. And folks, that's our show today. Be sure to tune in a week from today, the 15th of January, when my guest will be Elaine Meyerson, who has been the longtime director of what used to be called Shelter Our Sisters and is now called the Center for Hope and Safety. That's a domestic violence, anti-domestic violence program in Bergen County. So tune in for that at 10 o'clock. Tuesday morning, the 15th of January. And, of course, stay tuned to NorthJersey.com and Tomorrow's Record for all your Bergen County news. Till then.